Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Full Service Radio.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. This is our first live show of 2019.
Happy New Year.
I'm glad to still be alive in 2019. What a thrill.
Yeah, lucky you.
Lucky me.
And I guess lucky me.
Oh, definitely lucky you.
Yeah.
I know. I tell you that every night.
I know.
So we're broadcasting live from our fabulous Glaston studio here in the equally as fabulous Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. And a very interesting show today. I'll start off with a little bit of an intro. The National Museum of Women in the Arts is the only major museum in the world that is solely dedicated to exhibiting the work of women artists.
Which is really interesting. I'm going to interrupt you because, you know, given what's gone on in 2018 and Time's Up, you know, there's and all the women who are, you know, just came in for Congress, you know, there's a lot of focus, or at the Golden Globes last night, there's a lot of focus on women and women in the arts and being more inclusive. But this museum has been way ahead of
the
curve.
Museum opened in 1987.
Right. And the couple behind the museum have been collecting art specifically by women for years.
Well, we're going to hear about that story.
I know, it's fascinating.
How that got started. But Ginny Traynor is here with us from the museum. You're a curator there, correct?
I am the associate curator.
The associate
okay,
curator.
You got to get your butt in front of that mic.
Sorry.
Pull it up.
There it is. You can touch it. There you go. All right. Get your right in front. You got to put your face right in.
Look at
it.
Me.
I'm a newbie.
There you go. You're all good.
That's right. Ginny has curated a presentation that's up there now and will be through February 6th.
10th.
10th.
Mm-hmm.
10th. On the Rodarte Fashion House, and it's fabulous. But let's talk a little, let's kind of start with you. How do you get to be a museum curator?
You go to school until you're about 35 years old.
It's like becoming a doctor.
So that would have been last year, then.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're too kind. Yeah, it's a long road.
I mean, did you grow up saying, gee, I want to be a curator in a museum?
No.
So how did it start? When did you find art to really... How did you start gravitating towards art?
So looking back on it, I think it was probably in high school.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have art history in my high school, but my French teacher did a whole unit on the French Impressionists in my French class. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of fell in love with it from the art perspective that way. But I've always been interested in history.
So are you in it for the Monet?
Please don't listen to him.
Definitely not in it for the Monet.
No, you're not in it for the Monet at all.
No, not by any stretch of the imagination.
Not for the Manet either.
Not for the Manet either. Maybe even more so not for the Manet.
I'm just showing off my art history. That was it, by the way.
Thank God.
That's impressive. Well, now that you know there's a difference between Monet and Manet.
Now it's time for me to Van Gogh.
Oh, my God. This show's going to be taken off the air any minute now. Okay, so go ahead. But so you got turned on in your French class in high school.
Right. So I went to college. I was going to study history. And then I had my first art history class. And I thought, this is even better. This is like history with pictures.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to major in art history. And went straight from my undergraduate experience to a master's program.
Where did you go?
I went to American University here in Washington, one of the only feminist art history programs in the country.
Okay.
What does that mean?
That means studying art history from a feminist perspective.
And but that's not necessarily a woman's perspective, a feminist perspective, because it's really a different point of view.
It's a methodology.
Okay.
Like psychoanalytic or like Marxist or what have you. It's a particular kind of methodology of looking at art. So considering not only women artists, but how women are represented
or
in
portrayed.
Art.
Sure.
Portrayed in art.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that. I did my master's degree at AU, and was fairly burnt out by mm-hmm. the end of that. So I took a few years off. I was working at the Smithsonian American Art Museum.
Mm-hmm. But you, I thought you majored in Dutch art.
So that came later.
That came later.
That came later. Yeah. That was when I finally decided that what I wanted to do was be a curator, because by that point I had been working and interned in museums and saw that, you know, that path was really the one I wanted to be on.
Okay. So for the uninitiated, mm-hmm. what is a curator? What does it mean to curate an exhibit? I feel like that word, especially in the food world,
yes.
is so overused.
Yes.
Like curate a menu or curate a space, or, you know, everybody's
curating something.
Everybody's curating something. But really, curators began in the art world.
Mm.
So what did you see before you were an actual curator and you were like, this is what I want to do? What turned you on about that? And how did you decide that that was the step or the path that you wanted to take?
I think I decided that's the path I wanted to take because I saw that those were the positions in which people were researching mm-hmm. Artworks and artists and writing about them.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of doing the intellectual legwork of interpreting objects.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what interests me. Research,
right.
Writing. To curate really means to take care of something, mm-hmm. right? So you're taking care of either a collection in a museum or kind of curating a set of ideas about something.
Yeah, but aren't you more of a, you're, in a way, you're kind of an impresario too, because if they say to you, you know, we're really turned on by Rodarte and we want to do a, you know, there's a collection of stuff somewhere, but you have to really put the whole thing together in your head and come up with the presentation. It's
right.
like putting on a play.
Yeah. Yeah, it's curating an exhibition is mm-hmm. is definitely about having kind of a thesis, yeah. right, of,
right,
of a particular group of objects.
Mm-hmm.
But you can also curate, you know, we curate our permanent collection.
Sure.
And decide how things are going to go together and where they're going to go and how we're going to talk about them.
So you focused on Dutch art?
Okay, yeah.
Yeah,
so,
tell me.
So I went back. I decided I wanted to go back for my PhD.
Mm-hmm.
I went to the university. I was accepted to the University of Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
And
so we introduced her incorrectly. We didn't call her doctor. And that was kind of rude. So our apologies.
That's okay.
Doctor.
It's fine.
You know, I have this pain in my side.
Okay, stop. Just please.
Not the I'm not the useful kind of doctor,
yes, you
unfortunately.
Are. You're a doctor of art.
So, I went to Maryland, and I had, you have to do, you know, a bit of coursework, mm-hmm. and I had a class with Arthur Wheelock, who was, until very recently, the curator of Dutch and Flemish art at the National Gallery of Art.
Mm-hmm.
And
they have quite an exhibit there of that work.
They have a fantastic collection.
Yes.
And it really all kind of clicked for me in that instant, because my family had at that point been living in the Netherlands.
Oh, how nice.
For about 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was very familiar with the art and the culture and the people of the Netherlands. And so I decided to make that my focus.
Okay, so now we fast forward. And now you're at?
Now I'm at the National Museum of Women in the Arts.
Right. How did you wind up there?
So I was working on my coursework at UMD, I started working at the National Gallery
mm-hmm.
On a project. That contract ended. I had a baby.
It happens.
Had my first baby.
Mm-hmm.
Went back to campus, wrote my dissertation,
mm-hmm.
and defended my dissertation in December of 2011 when I was 8 months pregnant with my second.
Good for you.
Baby. And then I had a PhD and two babies.
In art history.
And now what do I do?
Right.
You actually had two. You had a PhD in babies and a
yeah, I did. Yeah. I didn't get paid for either of them.
That's okay.
So I was just, you know, I've been in the museum world in D.C. for a while. I thought I have a lot of contacts. You know, I just, you know.
Who you know, who you know.
Just kind of bide my time.
Mm-hmm.
While I was working on my dissertation, I had volunteered at the National Museum of Women in the Arts.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, there's no way I can sit in this tiny little study cube and for 8 hours a day and write. I need to do something else. And so I had a friend who I knew from working at the National Gallery, who was then working at NIMLA, as we call it. And so I went down, you know, a couple of times, volunteered my time, and got to know the people there. And, you know, the stars aligned. I don't know what else to say.
So for people who are not aware of this museum, because it is not a Smithsonian museum.
No, it's private.
It's a private museum. Can we get a little history of the museum?
Yeah, yeah.
Please.
So it opened in 1987, so we celebrated our 30th anniversary a few years ago. And it was started by Wilhelmina Cole Holiday and her husband Wallace, who made it their mission starting in the early 70s to collect art by women. And they were spurred to do this because they had been traveling in Europe and went to the Prado and saw four still life paintings by an artist, Flemish 17th century artist, Clara Peters.
Okay.
And they were blown away by these paintings, as I think anyone is who sees them. They're really masterpieces. They came back to the States and they wanted to know more about Clara Peters.
And nothing, right?
They couldn't find out any information about her. And then they realized they really couldn't find any information about any historical women artists. This is right before kind of that second wave feminism hits and feminist art history gets going and women artists are being rewritten back into the history books. This is before all of that.
So okay.
Once again, kind of ahead of the trend. So they start collecting art by women and then make it their mission to, you know, open a museum dedicated to women artists.
But then when they started collecting art, was it just all art by women? Was there a point of view? Was there a certain time period? How did they decide to collect their art?
I think their personal taste really geared towards European and American, I would say, Renaissance through 19th century.
Okay.
But...
You know, I took a Renaissance art course. I can't think of a woman artist. Not one.
Yeah.
I mean, you probably... How long ago did you take that course?
Doesn't matter.
Well, I'm just saying.
I can tell you about Sandro Botticelli. Right. I can tell you about all of them, but I can't... I don't think there was ever a woman artist that was ever, you know, that we ever learned about.
But they were there.
They were there.
Well, I'm saying, but my point is that you probably took that class in when? What year-ish?
1828.
No, but
that's
seriously.
Not the point.
Yes, it we're is, because I'm talking about curriculum changes.
We're talking about the 1970s when, which was exactly when I took that course, when, you know, women were invisible. I mean, they were the subjects of art.
Well, here's a good example. Janssen. H.W. Janssen published the first kind of comprehensive survey art history text in 1965, I believe. How many women were mentioned in it?
Probably like none.
Zero.
Isn't that amazing?
Zero.
Wow.
And this is about only 50 years after the death of Mary Cassatt, who was widely recognized in her own lifetime, very successful, had exhibitions, was part of the Impressionist movement, and yet she's not mentioned in that first edition of Janssen. She's literally been written out of the history book.
Amazing.
And so that's, yeah.
So would you say that part of the mission of the museum is to put women back into the history books?
To a certain extent, yes, because we do have a collection of historic works of art by women. And I think other institutions and other scholars are, you know, filling that void as well. I think more recently our focus has been on kind of focusing more on contemporary women artists working today,
showcasing them, giving them a platform,
and really like across the board, across the world.
Well, I was going to ask also about mediums. Is it specific to paintings, sculpture? Where does the heart lie for the museum?
So that core collection that came from the holidays when they opened the museum is really painting and sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
But since 1987, the museum has been expanding the collection and accessioning new things. We have a great photography collection, both mm-hmm. vintage photography and contemporary photography. We have a lot of mixed media things now. Contemporary art especially is well known for kind of wacky materials.
Well, that's Rodarte.
That's Rodarte. We have things made out of tires. We have this great Chikaya Booker piece that's made out of old rubber tires.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we...
Well, how does the museum, before we get into the current exhibit, can we talk about some of your constant installations that are always there so people have an idea of how they can view the museum, go through the museum? And then one of the other things I really want to talk about is, I mean, for so long, you would go to a museum and they'd be like, no pictures, stand back, mm-hmm. you're getting too close, blah, blah, blah. And in the age of social media, that's out the door.
Yeah.
I mean, more and more museums are interactive. They want the cameras out. They want people to interact with the art in different ways.
Yes.
So I wonder how that changes your constant installations or exhibits, and then how that feeds your like what you're going to do next. How it feeds your bringing in new exhibits. How you decide you want them there. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And it, you know, it's interesting because there is a little bit of give and take.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's nice being a smaller organization, a private institution, because we have a little bit more freedom to try out things mm-hmm. than maybe the Smithsonian might.
Right.
So we get to try out new things. And about 2 years ago, we decided to completely rehang our collection.
Mm.
It had been for a while at that point, it had been hung chronologically, which is pretty standard for
sure.
art museums, right? You go in.
Except for the barns.
Yeah,
there's
some notable exceptions right. to that rule.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided it wasn't showing our collection, to its best effect.
Mm-hmm.
And it was privileging certain narratives.
In what capacity?
Meaning that when you entered the museum, you would see all of the Renaissance and Baroque stuff in the Great Hall. You would see the 18th century French paintings on the mezzanine, and then you would go up to the third floor and see 19th century British, French, and American. And then not until you got to the back galleries would you see contemporary.
Mm.
So that meant you'd walk in. And you'd have to get through a lot of portraits.
You could get burnt out before you got to the contemporary.
You'd see a lot of still lives because mm-hmm. historically that's kind of what women artists were pushed into doing. So we scrapped that and we rehung everything thematically. And we just did a new rehang 2 weeks ago. So every year or two, we're hoping to introduce new themes.
So what is the theme right now?
So we have themes like Rebels with a Cause.
Mm-hmm.
So showcasing women artists who, and I'm sure the argument could be made for all of the artists in our collection, women who, push back against social boundaries and social mores to do what they want to do, what they feel compelled to do as artists. We have a section about...
They sort of drew outside the lines.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. We have a section about family and how women artists have frequently turned to their own family members as subjects for their art, or even showcasing the diversity of what family looks like in this day and age. We have a section about roots to roots, so about women traveling out in the world, but also connection to their own cultural heritage and cultural practice.
Mm-hmm.
So just a kind of a different way of curating, of bringing objects together and pointing out relationships between different objects.
Well, I would have to imagine, given your role with the museum, that has to be very exciting, knowing that in a year or two, you can take the collection that's there, working with art that you're familiar with, mm-hmm. and getting to reframe it, to represent it, to give it a different voice.
Yes.
That has to be exciting.
It is exciting, and I think it's exciting for our visitors, too. Mm-hmm. You know, those who maybe are tourists and are just coming in, you know, once, they get a good experience, but then also for our return visitors and for our members, you know, that there's something fresh happening constantly.
Well, and I do want to say, for people who are not familiar with the museum, it is a fabulous building right in the middle of the city.
It's great.
And yeah. It is. And it's a, but it's a large building.
It, was it an old, no, it was a Masonic temple. Wasn't
it was a Masonic
it?
Temple.
Is that what it was?
Yeah. Which is a really nice irony when you stop to think about it.
Yes, yes, it is.
Oh, I miss the patriarchal society. I was born too late.
So, the Met up in New York has become incredibly, I mean, it's an incredibly well-known museum, but they have done some outrageous art exhibits over the last 20 years, especially with the sort of anointing of the costume part of the mm-hmm. museum.
Did
with
we see
Anna
the
Wintour.
Chinese exhibit there?
Yes, yeah. That's through the Looking Glass. That was in 2015, but there was also the McQueen exhibit, which, you know, had like record numbers. Mm-hmm. And so the exhibition of design, clothing design, not just like what you see on the runway or what you see on the red carpet, has really become something that people flock to and want to see. And I what I think is most interesting about those exhibits is that it's really easy to put clothes on a hanger or even on a mannequin, right? Like,
it's actually not that easy. Okay, to maybe put clothes on a mannequin.
It may be hard to put a clothes on a mannequin, but you know what I mean. Like, there's so much thought that goes into how you display this form of art, not just as it was worn or who wore it or how it went down the runway, but shoes, belts, earrings, headdresses, all sort of jewelry, all sorts of accoutrements have to be taken in consideration, as well as the background.
Yes.
And the presentation. So what was it that led you all to do an exhibit on Rodarte?
So I think our director, Susan Sterling, really, you know, had the vision of doing a fashion exhibition at the museum. If you think about Washington, D.C., and places where you can go and see fashion, not in a store, but kind of in a museum setting,
There's nothing.
There's the first lady's gowns.
Well, that's
American
what I was gonna
history,
say. Right.
Which I love.
Yeah, yeah, but it's not fashion.
It's not contemporary fashion.
Well, that's for sure.
So there's really, there's a void. There's a void there, right? Mm-hmm. So she kind of thought about how can we fill this void? And, you know, was kind of looking to do a contemporary fashion exhibition and was put in touch with someone who was familiar with Rodarte and thought this is a great fit. You know, here are two young women who head their own fashion house and are, you know, the owners of their own business and kind of, you know, unexpectedly took the fashion world by storm.
I mean, they just didn't just unexpectedly.
They went like a rocket.
I mean, it's so rare for a fashion house to take off the way theirs
did.
Well, wait,
young designers. And I mean, it was 2005 they opened, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's crazy.
And they don't have formal training.
Right.
In fashion design. They didn't go to FIT. Actually, Kate, the older sister, was an art history major. Mm-hmm. And Laura majored in modern literature.
And so tell us a little bit about their history and how they came together and decided to become fashion designers.
Yeah, so I mean, they both went to Berkeley. Mm-hmm. They're both born and raised in Northern California and now live and work in L.A. They both went to Berkeley. They're just a year apart. They're very close. And they, after they graduated, saved up money. They learned to sew from their mother and, you know, put together some sample pieces on the kitchen table and, you know, sent things out and went to New York and...
The whole thing sold out.
I mean, they just, yeah, came out of nowhere.
But what was their initial point of view? What was it about their, like, their first couple of pieces that they felt that... What void did they feel that they were filling?
I think because they were, quote-unquote, outsiders.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they didn't have this traditional fashion training.
Right.
Really allowed them to approach fashion from a different point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't afraid to do things that maybe are considered unorthodox in terms of mixing really unexpected materials together. The kind of processes that they use, they shred things, they burn things, just really kind of unique and hadn't been seen before.
Mm-hmm. All right, on that note, I'm going to take a break. And then when we come back, we're going to get into the pieces that are showcased in this exhibit. I've had the pleasure of walking through it. It is truly spectacular. If you have not done so yet, you must go see the Vo d'Arte exhibit at the museum. But we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about how the exhibit was set up and about some of the other exhibits that are there at the museum. This is David and Nikki Nellis, Industry Night. We'll be back in a sec. Welcome back to Industry Night. It's Nikki and David Nellis. We're in the Gorgeous Line Hotel, and we are talking about the Vo d'Arte exhibit.
With Dr. Virginia Traynor.
Yes.
Associate curator at the National Women's Museum, right?
At the National Museum of Women in the Arts.
So,
it's a mouthful.
I want to start with...
It is a mouthful. That's why I can't keep saying it. It's a mouthful, but it is a fabulous museum.
Thank you.
All right, we've already talked a little, and people know we're going to be talking about Vo d'Arte and you know, and their couture collection. But when somebody finally says, I know what we want to do, we're going to do a Vo d'Arte thing, and we're going to call them. And how does the process go?
Right.
Because it's like building...
Do they just send you pieces, or do they send you photos? How does it work?
Well, it's a little bit different, mm-hmm. you know, every time, depending what the exhibition is. But in this case, you know, it was being connected with them and talking to them about the possibility of doing an exhibition of their work. As far as Vo d'Arte goes, this is not their first museum exhibition, although it is by far the largest
mm-hmm.
exhibition that they've okay. had in a museum. They've had pieces or collections highlighted before in 2010 at the Cooper Hewitt Museum in New York.
Okay.
They had a small exhibition at LACMA, I think either the year before or the year after. So they're familiar
with the process.
With the process, with the museum environment. And then we decided to hire a guest curator.
Mm-hmm.
My PhD is in 17th century Dutch art, which was fairly useless in this situation. So we decided to go with someone who knew a bit more about fashion exhibitions. And so Jill D'Alessandro came on board. She's mm-hmm. the curator of textile and fashion at the San Francisco Museum of Fine Arts and has a number of wonderful fashion exhibitions under her belt. So she agreed to come on board, and then she worked very closely with Kate and Laura Malavi of Vo d'Arte to select what would be exhibited in the show, and kind of, you know, worked with them to come up with the vision of the exhibition.
So they were very involved in the process.
Very, very involved.
So is the show themed, is it sort of Rodarte from then to now, or what's, how's it set up?
Yeah, I always joke, we can't really call it a retrospective because they're too young for that.
Right.
It's more of a survey of, you know, the first dozen or 13 years of their career.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not exhaustive. It's not every single thing from every single season and every single collection. But it is a very good survey and a good overview of the last 13 years.
Well, their pieces are so... So many of their different collections are vastly different from one another. They also did the costumes for Black Swan, which you have two of the pieces of.
Yes.
So, you said that they were very involved in the process. So did they select all the pieces, and then did they decide how they were displayed, or was that a collaboration and how that went together?
In collaboration with Jill D'Alessandro, the guest curator, I think it was really their intent to present the looks more or less as they were on the runway.
Mm-hmm.
All of the looks in the exhibition are from their archive, so they were all on the runway, with the exception of the Black Swan tutus, which were worn by Natalie Portman in the film.
And just for the record, for people who haven't been to the exhibit, they are sort of suspended in air, and they are really ethereal? Is that the right word? Like, they're so majestic, and they're so beautiful, and the detail is amazing, and they're displayed so beautifully.
Yeah, that's definitely one thing I think that visitors are rewarded with when they come to see these works in person.
Mm-hmm.
I myself was astounded by it because I've been looking at reproductions for 2 years now in anticipation of this exhibition. And even when the photo is really, really good, you still can't...
No, you can't
get the feeling of all that detail.
Mm-hmm. Well, plus, I think, again, this goes to how you displayed it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? The lighting is incredible.
Well, that's a good thing to talk about, because lighting is key with this.
Yes. Exactly.
You wash it out and it's not the same as if you have... So did they come and direct the lighting designer?
So we worked with a design firm out of New York, Rafael de Cardenas Incorporated, and worked with them on the exhibition design, and they in turn recommended a lighting designer that we worked with. And so again, everyone's all these different moving parts, so everyone's working very closely together. Our team at the museum with the design firm in New York and the lighting designer and Kate and Laura and Jill. We had people everywhere, San Francisco, LA, New York, DC.
But a lot of people are talking.
Yeah.
So as you laid it out, because it's in multiple rooms, was there a vision as to how people should take in the pieces and what you were supposed to get out of them? Like, you didn't want them starting in the back with the beautiful floral display, clearly, or else you would have put that up front. So,
spoiler alert.
Well, no, but that is a fabulous room.
Yeah.
So was there a progression that was in mind?
I think so. And, we usually consider those front galleries by the passenger elevators to be the front of the gallery. So we're kind of working on that. There is another entrance to the exhibition on the other end. It's not chronological, so it doesn't really matter how you go through it.
Okay.
But I think it was, the intent was that most people would be coming in, from that particular angle.
Mm-hmm.
So that gallery by the passenger elevators, was meant to be kind of the
introduction,
the pow factor.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, because I do feel like it sort of builds up.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? As
mm-hmm.
you're walking back to the final display room.
And there is something very kind of dramatic about that last room.
Yes, it's very dramatic.
Yeah.
And beautiful. Mm-hmm. And was that more of a collaboration between the curator and the designers? Because it's so intricate.
Yeah. And, we're constrained to a certain degree by the architecture.
Of course.
There are only so many walls you can tear down.
Right.
Everyone had to kind of work together to determine what was possible and what wasn't possible.
Well, how involved are they?
Very.
I mean, they're there every day and they're directing. And I mean, how long does the installation take?
So the installation for this exhibition took about 6 weeks. And they, Kate and Laura came with their team from LA the last week. And they, particularly that G Gallery, sorry, it's called our G Gallery, with the garden room, they were very interested in kind of putting their touch on.
Did they know of the museum beforehand? Had they heard of it?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
They did.
Mm-hmm. So the other thing that I think is really interesting is, so they must have had a partnership with Nicholas Kirkwood, because almost if the shoes aren't Rodarte, they're Nicholas Kirkwood.
There are also some Laboutins and some Manolo Blahnik.
Maybe the ones I kept looking at were Nicholas Kirkwood's.
Yeah.
They're pretty fabulous.
Yeah.
So did they pick all of those as well?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And were there times that you got to participate and sort of be like, what about this? What about, I mean, it sounds like a big collaboration among everybody.
Yeah. I wasn't involved so much on in those particular details.
Okay.
I was more of the project manager, so to speak.
Right.
The ringleader.
Sure. Making sure everything is happening.
Yeah. Yeah. Just keeping everything moving. And
well, given your history in, or your education in feminist art, how does that play for you in fashion? I mean, I know these are women artists, but, you know, you can either look at women's fashion through different lenses, especially from a feminist point of view. You know, if a woman chooses to wear something incredibly sexy, she can either own it or, you know, you look at Louboutin shoes, mm-hmm. which to me is always a great example because I have several and they're impossible to wear. Absolutely. Like, there is nothing about them that work.
I like to wear them around the house.
Well, he can fit his foot in them. But do you know what I'm saying? So there's always like, is it misogynistic? Or is it empowering? And where do you find Rodarte in that conversation?
I'm gonna deflect a little bit. I think, you know, when it comes to what you put on your body, I mean, obviously that's a very individual choice, and it can mean different things to different people. I will say, when it comes to showcasing Rodarte, an important thing for us has been to note that the industry, the fashion industry, even though it's so geared towards women, mm-hmm. you know, it caters to women, for better or for worse, it's dominated by men.
Right.
So here are two women, young women, who are the creative force behind the brand. They have the business acumen. You know, they're in control. Mm-hmm. And so that part of the story is really of interest to us in highlighting.
And how do you share that story within their artwork? I mean, I know you have lots of essays around that educate people. And there's also, it's not the entire film, but they did a film too.
They did a film
with Kirsten Dunst,
right? In 2017, it's their first feature-length film mm-hmm. called Woodshock. And we have seven costumes from that film that mm-hmm. were worn by Kirsten Dunst also in the exhibition. I think, you know, Kate and Laura are two highly creative people.
Clearly.
And so film, like fashion, is a creative outlet for them.
Mm-hmm.
We do. We have
like a piece of it, right?
We have a kind of a montage, short montage of the film playing, just to kind of give a sense of the atmosphere of that film. It's very, very kind of,
it's bizarre.
It's, I don't want to say moody, but it's dark.
It's dark.
Yeah.
It's really, I mean, I knew there was a longer version than what is showcasing at the museum, but you know, I was like, what?
Yeah.
I don't understand what's going on.
Is it darker than Bring It On?
No.
Another movie in which Kirsten Dunst starred.
It's a little darker than Bring It On. She's not wearing a cheerleading outfit. Oh. There's a lot of like, I don't know. I feel like she's like in the woods.
It's actually a very sad story.
Mm-hmm.
So the character that Kirsten Dunst plays assists her mother in committing suicide.
That's nice.
Yeah.
So that's uplifting.
Daughter should help her.
That's the bit. Well, she has a terminal illness.
Mm-hmm.
So she assists her mother. And then the rest.
Did they write it?
Yes. They wrote and they directed it.
Okay.
Yeah. And then the rest of the movie is this woman kind of coming to terms with what she has done or not, as the mm-hmm. case may be, because her mental state kind of starts to unravel. And that's reflected in the
clothing.
In the clothing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Now that makes so much more sense, because I don't think it's really clear what's really happening
in those clips.
In those clips, you know. But now the clothing makes sense.
Yes.
The other thing that's really interesting, and I was telling David this about the exhibit, is how well versed the security staff is in the exhibit.
Yeah.
So when you walk off the elevator. I mean, when you're in most museums, there's security staff obviously around, mm-hmm. and, you know, they may say hello to you if you engage, but they're not, well, they're not talking about yeah. the artwork. The security guard who was there that day, he told us where to go, what to do, what we were looking at, gave us advice. He was amazing. It, it totally changed our experience.
Oh, good. Yeah, our security staff is amazing. They're really wonderful. Again, so, because we're such a small staff, you know, we're all fairly close and we work with each other constantly every day, and our guards come to our, before we open an exhibition, we offer a training for our volunteers, and our guards come to that, and so, you know, we'll take them through, and they're also in there all
right,
the time.
They're in there all day,
so they're constantly listening to the tours being given, so yeah, they do know a lot about any exhibition that we have.
Can we talk about taking a tour? Because I think some people are, I don't know, I don't think it's something that they think to do when they go to a museum mm-hmm. to get a private tour or to get somebody to walk around with mm-hmm. to explain what you're looking at and why.
Well, do you have those little thingies you carry around that give you the walking tour without a guide?
The earphones?
Yeah, whatever they are.
For this exhibition, we don't, but in the past, we've done kind of, you know, it's accessible through your phone.
Sure,
you know,
like you
dial a number, and then you can hear a little bit. But we also offer free tours every Wednesday at noon.
Hmm.
Just, you know, people on their lunch break, or, you know, if you just want to pop in. And
because I think that totally changes the experience mm-hmm. when it's one thing to walk around and look and ooh and ah, whether it's, you know, the Rodarte exhibit or yeah. another art exhibit. But, and, you know, not everybody reads the pamphlets or, right. you know, knows everything. But when it's explained to yeah. you, like the Barnes to me is such an amazing example, because you can walk in there and be like, okay, here's some fabulous art. But to understand how, you
why
know,
it's hung that way,
why it's hung that yeah. way, that everything is hung specific to how they did it in their house mm-hmm. and that the only way it could be moved was if it was hung exactly, including like the Matisse, which is like painted on a wall. It's amazing. And there's so much education in it to see where their head was.
Yeah.
And why they, you know, the floral painting is above a vase, you know, like there's reasons yeah. for everything.
Yeah.
So is that something that you're able to supply at the museum?
Oh yeah. I mean, guided tours are always an option. Really, at any museum, you just have to, you know, be
ask
aware that that's an option and ask for it, or go online and make a reservation.
So at the museum now, since it's not a Smithsonian, I mean, DC is extremely spoiled,
yes.
not at the moment, but normally by free museums. What does it cost to go to this museum? How can people access it and really utilize?
How do you become a member?
How do you become a member? Exactly.
Just walk in and say, I want to become a member.
Mm-hmm. That sounds hard.
I think I'm a member. I think when I bought tickets to the yeah. Rodarte exhibit, I'm now a member.
Yeah. So we're free for members.
Mm-hmm.
I think our membership fee is $50 a year.
Right.
So that pays for itself pretty quickly. We have a $10 entry fee. I think it's a bit less for students and seniors,
mm-hmm.
maybe $8. And, you know, we're off the mall, right? We're off the beaten track a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
We do have an entry fee, so it puts us at a little bit of a disadvantage, you know, competing with the Smithsonians. We have one free day a month. The first Sunday of every month is free.
Oh, okay.
Yesterday was our free day.
Mm-hmm.
We had almost 2,000 people come through our doors yesterday. We had a line
wow.
out the door.
Congratulations.
And down the block. Thank you. I think it's because the Rodarte exhibition has been so popular.
Mm-hmm.
Might have had a little bit to do with the fact that all the other museums were closed.
Right. I think so.
Yeah.
And is so now, since the Rodarte exhibit has been so popular, is it something, is fashion something that you guys are going to plan on getting more into?
Yeah, I think, you know, moving forward, there's nothing in the, on the books yet, per se. Mm-hmm. But I think the intent moving forward is to really include fashion exhibitions in our future programming.
And how has, I mentioned this earlier, but we didn't really get into it. How has the use of social media changed the way the museum is about people with cameras and phones in your space? Because there's been a huge dynamic shift.
Yeah, that's been a huge change in the past few years. You know, from going to you see like no photography signs everywhere in museums, and now it's really encouraged because museums realize that's publicity.
Right. Well, not only that, it seems like what has to be built into your exhibit is that Instagrammable moment, right? So what is the, you know, everybody has to have the shot, like when the Renwick first launched.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was like, which was the shot that everybody had to have to prove
right.
that they were, you know, right. if you don't take a picture, did it really happen? So is there something in the Rodarte exhibit that you think is that moment? Or did you put that in when you were thinking about the exhibit?
I don't think so. I mean, that's really hard to say.
Okay.
I mean, I guess the garden room, mm-hmm. just by the sheer fact that there're flowers everywhere.
Everywhere.
You're not used to seeing that in a museum mm-hmm. setting, so it's kind of cool. The flowers and the hair and all of that. But, you know, there's some amazing details, too. You know, if someone's able to get up close and take an amazing detailed shot of something, I think that's, you know, worthy of Instagram as well.
Well, I took tons of pictures, and I Instagrammed all of them because I just thought it was, the lighting was incredible. So it allowed for terrific shots, and, you know, so many of their dresses have that gauze. So there's mm-hmm. either, you know, or the chiffon, like the long trains. The detail on those gauze dresses, you know, on that on the second room, so to speak, you know, where you can see that they burned it and played with it. It's just amazing. It's their work is really beautiful. And for those of you who are listening, if you're not familiar with Rodarte, you should absolutely go to their Instagram feed. They actually had two gowns last night in the Golden Globes. And it's R-O-D-A-R-T-E. Yeah. And they are really incredible designers and creative forces.
Yeah.
In the design world with a movie to boot. Yeah. All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today because I don't think the National Museum of Women in the Arts gets the kind of attention that it deserves. A lot of events are held there because the space is so stunning.
Yeah.
But I don't think people are as aware of all your regular exhibits or the changes, how you change your exhibits. I'm trying to find other words for curate, so I'm not saying curate all the time. And then
it's okay in this situation. You could use the word.
It's actually
appropriate.
Right? It actually makes sense. The Rodarte exhibit is available until
February 10th,
and then you will keep us posted when the next exhibit is coming.
You know what we should do is give the address of the museum.
Okay,
1250 New York Avenue, Northwest.
Right there.
Yeah, Metro Center.
Right near Metro Center. Mm-hmm. And can we have the website, please?
www.nmwa.org.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us
today.
Thank you
for having me.
It is a really beautiful...
Thank you, Doctor.
Yes, thank you, Doctor.
You're very welcome.
It was a really beautiful exhibit, and I so enjoyed it, and I really urge everybody to go and enjoy it while you still can. Next week's show is going to be completely different. Did you know that Guinness Brewery opened up right outside Baltimore?
I actually did.
I know.
Because you know why? Because
I told you.
Told me.
Well, the brewer is coming in studio, and we're going to be talking about...
I'm taking over the show.
We're going to be talking about why open a Guinness Brewery. I can't even pronounce it. Here,
Brewery.
Thank you. Here in the States, and the brewer is coming in, and he's going to tell us all about it. Okay. Should be pretty fabulous. Cool. Right. So thanks, everybody, for tuning in today. This is David and Nikki Nellis, Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. We'll be back next week.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher. and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.